Welcome to Glaring Admissions, an offshoot of the podcast Media Obscura, where my wonderful co-host Raekwon and I sit down and talk about classic movies that at least one of us has never seen before, or has only just seen recently. This is our inaugural episode, as I just said, like 10 seconds ago, and we've decided to just dive right into the deep end and cover a movie that I've literally been meaning to watch for like 20 years. We're talking about 1993's Jurassic Park today.
I think it's like just hilarious that you, the movie buff, you see all the, you can see some of the movies in your shot in the background.
Yeah.
And you've never seen Jurassic Park. Like, that's just wild to me.
It is. It's a weird thing. And it's why we thought this would be a fun show to make. Because, like, you and I obviously love movies, but we both, you can't just throw me under the bus. We both have glaring omissions in our diet as film fans, cinephiles, whatever. And I feel like everybody does, you know? Everyone's kind of ashamed that they've never seen Jaws, perhaps, or they've never seen To Break Away from Steven Spielberg movies. Maybe they've never seen Pulp Fiction. And there's something universal about that that I thought would make for a really fun show. I think, like, it's worth stating, some movies are almost too iconic, where everything about it has been, like, parodied or parroted over 20 or 30 years, to where somebody might say, well, why do I need to see Jurassic Park? I got the gist of it. Dinosaurs loose in an amusement park. I'll catch the rest of it on TikTok, you know? It is a thing, like, on TikTok all the time now. I get these recommended videos, which are just summaries of movies.
Yeah, I was going to mention TikTok as well. That's how a lot of people consume. You know, you can watch entire movies on TikTok.
Yeah,
now too.
And people do it for some reason.
But it's, your boy has strong feelings on that, watching a movie on your phone.
Yes, David Lynch. Yeah, he hates it.
He doesn't like that. But, you know, you're right. We both do have, like, some glaring omissions. Like, the getting back into a Spielberg movie is E.T. We've talked about that.
Yep.
Like, something where you kind of know what it's, you know what it's about. It's so iconic that you're like, I don't need to watch it.
Precisely. Like, I get it. Butterfingers, Yoda cameo during the Halloween scene. They replaced the shotguns with walkie-talkies on the old DVD release. Like, I get it. And then it's like, well, no, but you're depriving yourself of one of the great movies, and maybe there's something to be said there. So yeah, that's exactly what the show is. It's us sitting down and talking about iconic movies. Hopefully, by doing this show or this offshoot of Media Obscura, we're giving everyone like a place where they can just gush about movies they like. Like, I would genuinely love to hear people's story. Like,
how
old were you when you saw Jurassic Park? Did you see it in theaters? You know, stuff like that, because like movies, that's movie watching is a communal experience. You go to a theater with people and you watch it, you know, so it'd be cool to just hear everyone's thoughts on that matter. So yeah, I mean, let's just dive into things. Yes, Jurassic Park, I didn't see it as a kid. I have good reasons. I think it's not just ignorance on my part. I won't bore everyone with the details, but I'll give them very quickly. One, my parents are both immigrants. I'm a first generation American. They don't really go to the movies, so they wouldn't have seen Jurassic Park in theaters. They have no closeness to it, and they're not science fiction fantasy people.
Way to play the first generation American card.
Well, I have to protect myself somehow. Two, I saw Jurassic Park 3 in theaters in 2001 when it dropped. I was like 6 years old. I saw it in theaters and I hated it. It scared me because I was a dumb kid. And yeah, it kind of just pushed me away from Jurassic Park.
Okay.
Three, by the time I was old enough to actually see and appreciate it, I was already watching a lot of video essays. And it's like what we had said earlier, where I learned everything about the movie. Oh, this is why Jurassic Park is important. I saw it in a very academic way.
Right.
So by then I was like, well, I don't need to see the movie now. I want to, but I just never did. And oh my God, was I wrong about this? It's not that I ever thought it was bad, but I saw the movie twice. I saw it 2 weeks ago and I saw it again last night in preparation for this video. And both times I walked away with just such a, like, I think the way I worded it in my Letterboxd is the best way I can ever describe this movie. Steven Spielberg really is like one of the best to ever do it.
Yo, same, like, same. Actually, I have that in my notes too. I was like, yo, Steven Spielberg is just like the man. Like, that's it.
But no, he really is like one of the best to ever do it. This movie was so much more than the technical achievements. Mm-hmm. And it's weird how undersung its positive qualities are. Because every time someone mentions Jurassic Park, they always talk about the T-Rex, the CG, and the Velociraptor puppets. And those are great. And they've aged very well in most cases. I think I only counted one T-Rex shot where I was like, that doesn't look good.
When he was chasing the car?
Yep. Yeah. That was the only time.
Or she, but, sorry.
Yes, she. Don't misgender the T-Rex. When I say that Spielberg is really one of the best to ever do it, I'm talking about how thematically dense this is. Because like a big theme in this movie, for me at least, was the idea of male hubris. Specifically man.
Dude, we're like... here with it. But continue.
Well, I mean, that's basically it. It's the idea that all of these men are convinced that they have the wherewithal to be creators, that they can be God, essentially, to the point where John Hammond is literally wearing white. He's like almost appearing as like this godlike figure.
Yeah, yeah.
He wants to be there for every birth of the dinosaurs. And they're all woefully unprepared. Like, Ian Malcolm, he literally says, you know, you guys cheated to get where you are. You took other people's work and you extrapolated on it, but you never did the footwork to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
It's fascinating, like such a deep movie. And I genuinely believe it when I say that Jurassic Park is like super feminist.
Why do you think that?
Because like all of the men are playing these kind of creatorly roles in it. And they're all doing a horrible job of it. It's all hubris. And then the competent characters who end up saving the day are the only two women on the island. It's Ellie, Laura Dern's character. And I forget the little girl's name, but the little girl.
Yeah.
And like what's so interesting about it, and I say this because I know someone somewhere is going to bad faith me for saying this. It's not because like men suck and women rock that this is feminist, nor is it even every man in the story, because Alan learns a lesson and he kind of overcomes a lot of what the people fall victim to in this. These characters don't, like, they don't talk shit during the movie at all. They're never in over their heads so much as they just happen to have the goods. Laura Dern's character by being a botanist, and what's her face by being like a hacker.
Yeah, I wrote in my notes, OMG, she's a hacker. Like when they mentioned one time that she was maybe a nerd, which was also, I had a note about Timmy teasing her for being a nerd.
Yeah.
When he's like the biggest dinosaur nerd of all time.
Right.
That was just a good bit of dialogue there, because they're brother and sister. Mm-hmm. And he's like, you're such a nerd. You like computers and stuff. And this kid is like quoting Alan's book back to him about dinosaurs and how they're like more similar to birds than reptiles and stuff.
I think one thing that stood out to me was this movie feels like very classically movie. That's such a weird empty statement, I know. But
I think I know what you mean.
For a movie these days to come out, and I'm really curious to see how like the Jurassic World series fares in regards to this. like movies these days feel a lot more cynical. They're always like kind of winking and nudging at the audience about something. And Jurassic Park never quite feels that way to me. It feels very earnest. It wears its heart on its sleeves. And it has this sentimentality that is so Spielberg, but also just like so American filmmaking from back then. It has like a very satisfying arc.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess we can just jump around because it's such an iconic movie. But the ending shot of the film, they're leaving the island finally. Alan has had this arc because Alan has hated kids. And through the experiences here, he changes, he grows, he comes to love Timmy and the sister.
Lex.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, he loves Timmy and Lex now. You know, he's grown. And all that stuff you were saying, you mentioned that he believes dinosaurs are more related to birds than reptiles.
Yeah.
And that is so perfect, because when they're leaving the island, he sees a flock of birds. And I just, that blew my mind. Like, actually... because it's such good filmmaking on Spielberg's part. This whole movie, Alan has dedicated his life to dinosaurs. It's the only thing he knows. He doesn't know how to act around people. If you look throughout the movie, anytime he tries to like interact with somebody, he always has this like perplexed, dumbfounded look on his face. And through this like dark night of the soul he has, where he has to care for and take care of these kids, he learns the value of traveling in a pack, of having his own flock. And he has grown as a character. He went from a dinosaur person into a bird person, so to speak. He has evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't really teach that in film school, can you? Like, I mean, maybe you can, but that's just really good storytelling.
It could have been done in a way where we're like, that's kind of cheap or lame or
it's
whatever.
Cheesy.
Yeah, but it really didn't feel like that. It did evoke an emotion from me watching it. Like, I'm not like crying or anything, but I'm like, wow, that's...
You're too hard to cry.
Yeah, too hard.
You were just like, you felt them coming and you were like, nah, man.
Nah, no, nah. No tears.
No tears, no cry. But no, I totally feel like, I totally know what you mean. It's just, it's earned is what it is. It's properly set up. Mm-hmm. The audience is reminded of it by Timmy's pestering, you know? And another really good example of that is Lex being a hacker. They're getting into the Jeeps, and the first thing Lex does, like literally her first or second line in the movie, is like, oh, look, an interactive CD-ROM. And it's like, oh, okay, why would a kid know all about this? Oh, it's a tech. The kid's a techie.
You know, I didn't get that she was a techie from that line. I just thought that like she was interested in it. But even so, when they mention it again, where she actually says that she's a hacker, it was set up well, because that happened right after the herbivore.
Yes.
Yeah. I forget the name of that dinosaur right
the,
now.
The one with like the giant neck.
Yeah. The
Giraffosaurus.
The Giraffosaurus. When it sneezed on her, and he's like, oh, great. Like, now she's never going to do anything. She's going to stay in her room like she always does. That didn't feel cheap or anything. Like you said, it's earned, because it's just good storytelling.
Yeah. And it's thematically like in line with the rest of the movie. Like I said, the men in this movie are like purely these creatures of hubris. They keep underestimating everything.
Yeah.
And the women in the film are competent. They know what they're doing. You know, they have this deeper understanding of things than everyone else around them seems to. So it doesn't feel weird when she understands how to use a computer. Likewise, like Laura Dern in this movie is so good.
Yeah.
She literally played every scene she was in so well. I joked to you yesterday that I got whiplash watching this, because I had just rewatched Inland Empire like a day earlier, where like Laura Dern is literally losing her mind for 3 hours. Here, she's just fighting dinosaurs. She's fine.
Yeah.
She's fine. Samuel L. Jackson's handle keeper safe. So this is one thing I didn't expect, is simultaneously how much and how little Jeff Goldblum was in this movie. Because as a person who's only engaged with Jurassic Park through pop culture, I was surprised to see that every scene with Jeff Goldblum in it is like a quotable thing or a meme.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, and for the longest time, I just thought these were the highlights of his performance. And they were, but they were also his entire performance.
Yep.
You know, I had this joke when I used to make music that my first album should be called Greatest Hits. Because it's literally fucking everything I've done up to now. You know, so it's my greatest hits album.
Yeah.
And that's what it feels like. He stole every scene he was in. Like
the scene where he already is injured and he's got his shirt open, and that's like a meme, but I don't know. It was very dramatic in the moment.
It felt very like, hey, he's doing this on set, and Spielberg's vibing with it.
Yeah.
So whatever.
It's like, hey, he's an attractive guy. Let's just pan from his like legs to his head.
Actually, I know people simp over Jeff Goldblum. I know like a lot of women think like 80s, 90s Jeff Goldblum is really hot. I get it after this movie.
Okay, I thought you were going to talk some
shit. No. I think by now Jeff Goldblum has kind of become self-parody, which is a shame. But like, I get it. The Jeff Goldblum of like The Fly, Earth Girls Are Easy, and Jurassic Park. I get it suddenly.
Okay. Did you know that Jim Carrey auditioned for this role?
Really?
Yeah.
That would have been great.
It would have been great, but now I don't think that...
No one else could have played it, though.
Yeah, like, whoever it would have been different if it was different people, like, auditioning. But the way Jeff Goldblum did it, I feel like... I think I would have bought more that Jeff Goldblum is a, like, mathematician, like, genius, more than Jim Carrey.
Jim Carrey, I'm sure, would have played it like Edward Nigma in Batman Forever, where it's not really a character insofar that it's Jim Carrey.
Yeah, which isn't much different than what Jeff Goldblum's doing.
Yeah, but Jeff Goldblum suits the role. I don't know. It's apples and oranges. But yeah, no, he did so good. And like, he's always doing something interesting. Like, even when he's in the car and he's flirting with Laura Dern with a hand, like, oh, little imperfections, imperfections, you know, like that whole thing. I love doing the Goldblum.
This had to have been one of those iconic movies for him where people did start kind of doing an impression, because he was just himself from the jump. Like when we first meet him, and Hammond calls him a rock star. He's like, oh, I bring scientists, you bring a rock star. It's like, he pretty much is that. He's just like
not even a rock star. He just seemed like a person who was completely and utterly content with himself.
Mm-hmm.
But what's so great about it too, and this is why his casting felt good to me, was he is a specialist in chaos theory.
Mm.
So all of these choices that Jeff Goldblum's making aren't just interesting, fun choices for an audience member, but it's like simpatico with the character.
Yeah.
You know, the weird way he's playing with Laura Dern's hair in the car, like totally fits this guy who believes in causality. And like, if a butterfly flaps its wings in Central Park, and suddenly you have the next ice age.
And him flirting with Laura Dern's character in the car was like, I did feel like he was being really like blatant about, like, obvious, like flirting with her, flicking her hair, holding her hand and being like, oh, turn your hand. He's like touching it like slowly.
I think I'm going to take a ride when this is Sattler.
And he didn't really confirm with him until he asked after that scene if they were seeing each other or not.
And he didn't even check until like halfway through the movie.
Right. And which also thought played well, because Alan and Ellie, it's not 100% clear that they're together. It's not like,
no, I mean, it's clear insofar that like at the beginning of the movie, he's like talking to her and he's like, you really want to have kids?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. And it seemed like their relationship was like, whatever, I guess it doesn't really matter, but it's not so in your face about it, which is cool too, because I think that it would have made it seem more like a bit of like a love story.
Yeah, it's not a love story at all. It's like the stakes of Jurassic Park, dinosaur attack aside, which we somehow haven't even talked about yet.
Right.
The stakes are very personal. Mm-hmm. It's very existential. It's Alan doesn't want to have kids. Ellie does. They're here. Alan has been thrust into this situation where he has to care for kids. And Ellie has been thrust into this situation where she needs to make sure that Alan doesn't die. And that's what's so good and refreshing about it. It isn't a love story. I feel like anyone else would have just made it, oh no, there are no kids. The two of them get trapped and they have to save the day. They have to get away from the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But no, the arc isn't that. It's what I just said. It's survival, but it's taking care of kids, which I guess like is a great segue. We need to talk about Hammond and some of the other characters, but I really want to touch on Alan Grant, because he is so good. Oh my God, he is the best boy. No, just the wonder in his face when he sees the brontosaurus.
Yeah, yeah.
The scene after the T-Rex attack, when the kids are on the tree with him and they're like, will you stay up all night? And he's like, yeah, I'll stay up all night. Mm-hmm. It's just like, ah, it's the perfect coda to the movie. Ah, it's so, again, it's very classically movie.
Yep. And then when they wake up, we get that moment where the Giraffosaurus. We should look up the actual name.
It's the Brontosaurus.
Brontosaurus. where they get woken up by the Brontosaurus, and he was explaining to them, you see him starting to change a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's such a good point. And his character is just a blast. It's the little things, too. I had a bit of the movie on earlier, and one of the things that struck me is when he meets Timmy and Lex. Her name is Lex, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm bad with names in general, to be fair.
Not just women.
Yeah. Jonathan, is it? I've known you for 8 years. I think your name is Jonathan.
Yeah, just exactly.
But no, like when he meets the kids, even then, like if you look at him, he's like bugging out. He's like freaking out as the kids show up for the first time. And Ellie is having the time of her life just throwing him into situations where he has to interact with kids. But it's so interesting, and you really feel for him and you feel for his growth. You also feel that like Ellie is just having a little fun at his expense, but she really is trying to help him grow.
Yeah.
And that kind of goes back to what I was saying about this movie being like, these characters are very strong, rounded people. But what I really appreciated about like Ellie as a character or Lex as a character is that they don't shed their femininity to be strong characters.
Mm-hmm.
They're not like Sarah Connor in Terminator 2, who is by definition, she's a very strong female character, but she has stripped herself of everything that makes her feminine. She is a cold hearted, like gun toting badass character.
Yep.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's so refreshing to see a character, especially in like the early 90s, that is so like fully realized and just three dimensional, you know, especially in the kind of movie that this is.
Yeah.
It's one thing to have these characters in like a drama or something, but this is like a blockbuster action movie. I don't really call it an action movie, but that's what the wiki calls it. To have such a thought out, developed person there is like cool. And also, just to go back, because I'm sure some person in the audience is like, this movie isn't feminist. yes, it is. Like, they literally, there's the scene in the Jeep where like Ian Malcolm is like,
God creates dinosaurs. God destroys dinosaurs. God creates man. Man destroys God. Man creates dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs eat man. Woman inherits the earth.
I remember that. That
you was, know?
Yeah.
So, yes, it is a very feminist piece of filmmaking, and we love it for it.
A big part of why this is, you know, very feminist or just very progressive in terms of like, which is usually the case, by the way. I know I fucking interrupted my own thought, but like, it's usually the case that the women are usually the smart ones if we're talking about like an action movie. Like, or
well, they're usually the damsel in distress in a lot of these, like,
yeah,
in any,
true.
In any other movie, it would have been her getting chased by the like the T-Rex, or it would have been her climbing the electric fence.
Yeah, we got to go save her, like, kind of thing. But like, I'm thinking, I guess, in okay, they're both are smart people, they're both professions in paleontology.
She's a paleobotanist specifically.
Oh yeah, she is. Yeah.
She's specific to plants.
And then he is the paleontologist.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So,
which is, by the way, very, very, very not subtle. She is the paleobotanist, plants which need to be nurtured and cared for and helped to grow.
Mm-hmm.
Just saying, you know, a little bit of that first year of college literary analysis for you.
I just thought that it was super cool that she is trying to help him grow, but like, it's always like, you know, not to be that guy, the trope of being like, oh, if you find a good woman, it's the woman that is like helping you grow and cares about you becoming a better person,
which is, it is unfortunately kind of like a trope or something people say.
It's just something
which is funny, because like, why specify it to women? Just
just whoever, like your person.
You should just meet somebody who helps you grow,
someone that treats you nice.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that's not even gender specific.
Yeah,
you know, it doesn't need to be.
Mm-hmm.
But no, I know what you mean. I think it's great. I think they're genuinely great characters, and they complement each other really well. And then we'll talk about Hammond in a sec.
Yeah.
I know, I keep teasing talking about Hammond, that Santa Claus looking guy. Mm-hmm. But no, I really want to, before I forget, we do need to talk about the Newman-sized hole in the wall, Nedry.
Who's that, the lawyer?
No. He's the computer guy who's trying to steal the samples, the embryos.
Oh, yeah.
Newman.
Yeah. Newman. Okay. Yeah.
Every time he does something in this movie, I just imagine Newman. But he was great too.
Yeah,
and like,
he's so funny.
He was like clearly the comic relief character, but at the same time, he too thematically lines up with everything. He has hubris to think that he has the right to do this, hubris to think that he can outsmart and outwit everybody. And then it blows up in his face. Like, he can't even like act nonchalant about going to do the thing he was sent to do.
And it's funny, like, speaking of that in hubris, his hubris is that he may be good at his job, but he also isn't the guy there. Like, he says to Hammond, like, oh, try to find someone else in a short amount of time.
At my pay rate.
Yeah, that'll, you know. So it's not like someone else couldn't do what he's doing. And he also seems like a slacker and a bit of a slob too. So
he just has straight up porn on his computer.
Yeah, right. He's not like super cunning or anything like
yeah.
that. So he's just trying to make a buck.
And here's the thing. He does all this stuff. He has undervalued his own labor because he's complaining he wants more money.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to point this out because it's a great segue for when we talk about Hammond. Hammond has a catchphrase in this movie. You know what it is already.
Yeah.
He spared no expense.
Spare no expense.
Who did he spare an expense on?
The guy that ended
Nedry.
Up stealing from him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So how about that?
Mm-hmm.
But it's perfect. Like, no. Maybe he didn't spare an expense because he didn't think Nedry was worth more than that. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And he turns out to be right. I mean, Nedry dies a horrible death. He gets acid spit on him,
mm-hmm.
and then he gets eaten alive in a car.
Yeah.
Like, what a horrible way to go out.
One thing that I just want to point out, this is rated PG.
Oh, yeah. This is a PG movie.
Yeah. For in 1993, I mean, I guess they're pretty loose with it because there's some gruesome deaths in this thing, but it's cut really well.
Yeah. It's funny you mentioned that this is PG and not PG-13, because mm-hmm. I do have trivia for you.
Okay.
Steven Spielberg is the reason there's a PG-13 rating. So It's really funny that this wasn't PG-13.
Mm.
Yeah. For Raiders of the Lost Ark, too many kids got scared by the end of the movie with like the Nazis and all that stuff, their faces melting.
Yeah.
So they made the PG-13. Yeah.
That's funny as hell.
I think it was either that or it was Temple of Doom. It was one of the Indiana Jones movies. So it's just really funny that this wasn't that.
Yeah.
And this had like tie-ins with everyone's making toys for it. There was a McDonald's tie-in. Mm. So I guess maybe there was too much money for the, you know, the guys to give it a PG-13. But at any rate, yes, Nedry, he's a great character. I love him. Again, every scene with Nedry in this movie, instantly quotable. Dachshund, see, nobody cares.
Dachshund here. Yeah. I love that scene too.
Yeah. And it's great. And what I love about the Nedry reveal is he is such a nobody in the eyes of the movie. I know he's our inciting incident. I know that, but he is such a nobody as a person, like a physical human being, that they don't even name Nedry when we first meet him. He's just a guy.
Mm.
And then when we are introduced to him by name, it's just Samuel L. Jackson's just like, yo, Nedry. Like, but that's so interesting to me because he's not a character. Yeah, he is a character, but he's like such a minuscule part of Jurassic Park, the location.
Yeah.
That he doesn't even get named as a main player.
And I guess that's cool because it does speak to why he is doing what he's doing.
Yeah.
Like he just feels smaller and, you know, trying to get his money. And to go, you know, we talked or you mentioned the stakes here.
Yeah.
This is a pretty insane thing to do for him to be like, oh, yeah, I'm just going to steal some embryos and I'm going to sell them. That's like, it speaks to what you were saying about hubris, which is, I didn't make a note of this, but I remember, I thought about that with Hammond. It's funny to me that he doesn't seem like the worst guy, but he does seem like a naive person that believes in, he doesn't even really believe in himself so much as that he believes in the fact that, oh, because I spared no expense and I, you know, paid all this money and got the best people because I paid the best people. And
Except Nedry.
The one guy who decided to steal from him. He's like,
Cheeto dust fingers Nedry over there.
Cheeto dust fingers porn on the laptop.
Yeah.
And not on a desktop.
We don't even need a black light to know where Nedry's been.
But yeah, it's just interesting that Hammond, I liked him as a character, sure. But I'm like, dude, this is just his fault. And it's only because he, like Malcolm said, you didn't do any of the work. He basically just threw money at a thing and like some great results came back. But how is this sustainable is my thing. That's always been my thought watching like Jurassic World and then rewatching this. I'm like, what's the end game here?
Make a sustainable business.
Yeah, like you have T-Rexes, Velociraptors, and just a bunch of a lot of different types of dinosaurs. What's this going to be like in like 20 years? What's this park going to be like? Like, are we putting down dinosaurs? I feel like they live a pretty long time, especially if they're not if you're feeding them.
Yeah, you just get a big enough rock.
In like 10 years, we're going to put you down, old girl.
We're just going to clone Babe Ruth and make him like 100 feet tall. Just pitch a meteor at them. He's not a pitcher. He would need a giant cloned bat. Probably an aluminum bat. I know it's probably like a little cheaty, like, but we're trying to kill dinosaurs. We're not trying to play baseball, you know. Use an aluminum bat.
Ridiculous.
It's not even a real aluminum bat. It's a clone of the aluminum bat.
Cut to a picture of the fucking Titans from Attack on Titans. Like, yeah, we need one of those.
Give me a Babe Ruth that's as big as one of those things, you know.
Is there a Babe Ruth Beast Titan we could use to defeat the dinosaurs?
A BRBT, if you will, you know. No, but the best part is these cloned aluminum bats. They eventually develop the extra chromosome like the other dinosaurs did. So there are little eggs for giant aluminum bats.
Oh, my God. But that was just my thought watching this was like...
No. Hold up. So one other thing about sustainable business is that fossil fuels are made from fossils. Why not use this to solve gas shortages? You're killing the planet faster. That's why. Mm. But you know what I mean? Mm. Everyone was immediately like, we got dinosaurs. Take that, Disney. Like, we're going to open a real magic kingdom.
Yeah. And it's funny that Malcolm was the voice of reason from the beginning, because the paleobotanist and the paleontologist were like, oh, dinosaurs. Yeah. And he's like, okay, well,
they were against it too, but I think they were a little clouded by their love of it.
But Malcolm really wasn't like, holy shit. He's just like, you done it now. He's like, you son of a bitch, you did it. And he's just like, you have the most like advanced technology in genetic engineering and you're selling it. Like, what the fuck are we doing here? Like, like, seriously though, because if you can do something like this, wouldn't this be great for like medical research? I'm not trying to be like lame or something or whatever.
No, but look, spoiler alert, the lame answer is usually the one you should go with for most things.
Yeah, right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. It's really crazy, but that's America for you too. I thought like everybody was against it, but they gave him that monologue about it, and he's just like, dude, like it is really insane that this was possible, that somebody's like, let's build a goddamn theme park. Like, let's do it, guys. Like, we should build theme parks. No one else knows on except for, I mean, I didn't think that he had a competitor, like a company.
There were other companies trying to do similar things.
Yeah.
But I don't know if they were thinking theme park,
mm-hmm.
which makes it really funny that there are like six of these movies.
Yeah, right.
Like, the theme park didn't work in the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept going back. They were like, well, this time we actually locked the cages. We got to use real doorknobs instead of the like ones that raptors can open.
Yeah. Right.
Which is great. I love, okay, the two raptors are trapped in the room, right? Yeah. Unless they figure out how to use doorknobs. And then literally the next shot.
The next shot, you see the door opening, but you see his hand, his claw on it, just pulling it down. I was like, no fucking way.
I love it though, because like, it's so stupid. Like, the velociraptors being so this funny. Smart is so funny.
Yeah.
Like, the velociraptors are really smart. They work on trial and error. So I'm imagining like three velociraptors in a trench coat trying to go to an R-rated movie. All right. Do you have an ID with you? You left it in the car?
According to this movie, it probably would start shaking its head yes and no.
Yeah, like, exactly. It's looking at us like it's trying to figure something out.
Yeah, that was a weird line.
Just a velociraptor with a Rubik's Cube.
But that shit was hilarious, because when I saw it opening the door, of course, it immediately cuts the door being open. But I thought it would use its head. I thought it would be using its head.
I thought that too. But it used its fucking hands.
Yeah, but it's just peeking in there. Yeah. That was so funny.
The funniest shit in the world is like actually the velociraptor. But you know what? I give them so many props for making the velociraptors the big bad instead of the T-Rex.
Yeah.
Because that's also just a tease, because I'm sure everyone who saw this back in the day thought it was the T-Rex.
Mm-hmm.
T-Rex ends up saving the day. He's a bro.
Yeah.
He's cool. But like, it's the Velociraptors, and it's so misleading. Like, the logo to Jurassic Park is of a T-Rex, you know?
And they do the foreshadowing heavy when they witness the birth of the raptors. And, oh no. Yeah, he had a raptor in
his
hand.
They do it like three times. The opening scene of the movie is them putting the Velociraptors in.
Oh, by the way, let me make sure I have his name right.
Who, the big game hunter?
No, the first guy that dies in the opening scene.
Oh, okay.
R.I.P. Joffrey. Of course, the black man dies in the first few seconds of this movie. This is not even a horror movie, but it has horror tones because...
Well, Sam Jackson's the first one of the main characters we like to die to. I mean, the lawyer, but...
But you remember the guy that got killed, they're like, raise the gates, Joffrey! And he, like, raises the gates, and the raptor, like, bumps the cage, and he just fucking falls down. Like, damn, rip. Like, it's got to be him.
You know you're in for some shit now.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Once a black person dies, now it's open season. Now it leaves, like, room for, you know, several other characters are going to die.
Yeah. I really appreciated, though, the big game hunter character.
Yeah, I liked him.
He was cool. And what was so great about him is I didn't realize that Clever Girl was from this.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, I knew it was from something, but every time I hear Clever Girl, I think a Team Four Star, Dragon Ball Z Abridged, because Jace from the Ginyu Force, his last words before he dies is, Clever Girl.
That's funny.
So I didn't realize it was a Jurassic Park reference, and then I forgot it was a Jurassic Park reference, because I saw the movie, and I watched it again yesterday. So when I heard it again, I was like, it is a Jurassic Park reference.
Clever Girl. That was cool, though, because the hunter, I liked his character, because... he wasn't the typical hunter where he's kind of just like that archetype brute, former military, fucking gun crazy and kind of wild.
No, he's a cool dude.
Yeah, he's a nice guy. And I would
have a beer with all of these characters, even Nedry. But I feel like it's because I want to watch Nedry fall down.
I want to watch him slip out of his chair.
Yeah.
He's a cool guy, but he also respects the animals, the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Like, they're highly intelligent. Problem solving even.
He's a lot more Steve Irwin than like Crocodile Dundee, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so cool. He's a really memorable character. And he has like, of everyone there, he has this intimate knowledge of the dinosaurs. Like, he knows the Velociraptors are dangerous. I think he knows to remain still in front of a T-Rex. By the way, not accurate at all.
Yeah, I mean, can't they smell as well?
They have incredible eyesight.
Oh.
Yeah. According to research, they have great color vision, even
which
another thing that I want to talk about with the hubris is these guys spared no expense to make a bunch of dinosaurs, but they couldn't even make them genetically accurate. So
I guess
it's kind of like an ironic joke.
Yeah.
Almost.
They may feel like they have a workaround there because they like engineered all their DNA.
How are you going to know?
Yeah,
sure.
They take away we're going to take away their eyesight.
Like, yeah, yeah. I'm just saying, like, it's fascinating, but he's a great character. And he's just great. Like, all the characters in this movie have good dialogue.
Yeah.
Hammond with his sparing no expense. He's sort of like Walt Disney-esque a little bit.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
The hubris of Hammond, the balls on this guy. I couldn't get over that watching it. You know, I've said my piece on the sustainability of the business, but like I want to say what an asshole, but because we see the end result, but I don't know. It's just like, what did you think was going
to
happen?
Exactly.
that's the thing.
He means well, he does ultimately learn to like, no, we got to protect everybody and fuck the dinosaurs, you know, like,
Fuck the dinosaurs.
No, don't you even. but, you know, like, we learn this stuff, but it's interesting to see. He does grow. I wouldn't be surprised if by the sequels he's, like, against doing it.
Hammond, after careful consideration, I've decided not to endorse your park. So have I.
Okay, let me ask you a question. Did you feel like they should have done, you know, the end game? The very last resort. Let's kill all the dinosaurs. Did you feel like they should have done that? Or were you like, oh, that's like inhumane? Because they face a similar problem in, I don't know.
It's a big ethical question.
Yeah. Right. Because they have the same issue in Jurassic World. Like,
do you kill all the dinosaurs or don't you?
Yeah.
I feel like you put this safety contingency in place for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
These are animals that have been brought back, but they're also manufactured animals.
Mm-hmm.
What I'm saying is, I guess I could be convinced to go either way on it.
Yeah.
They probably should have killed all of the dinosaurs. Because not even these main characters are the only ones in danger. There are other personnel at the park that are just gone.
Mm-hmm.
That's a weird thing that I noticed. They never explain what happened to everyone else at the park.
And I haven't seen Jurassic Park 2, I don't think. Or 3. Like, I've
Lost
seen,
World and Jurassic Park 3.
Yeah, I haven't seen them. So I didn't feel bad. It is an ethical question because I could go back and forth on it. The same question is posed in Jurassic World. Mm-hmm. And I felt like they shouldn't have done it in that one, and they didn't. That would have been wrong. But in this case, number one, while the system was down, who knows how many dinosaurs got off the island?
Yeah.
This whole contingency plan is for the, just in case that a dinosaur gets off of the island, so we can just get rid of it, because it's like, where, how are we going to get it back or whatever?
Sure.
Everything's locked down.
The contingency plan is, it's built around they don't produce lysine.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm assuming the food they give the dinosaurs has this this thing in mm-hmm. it to keep them alive. So I think it's also just like, we can either wait it out. There isn't like a push a button and every dinosaur drops dead.
But that's how it is. That's how it was in the Jurassic World.
Oh, they had like a proper kill switch.
They were going to like gas them.
Jesus.
Crazy, right?
Yeah.
And because it was just like, not to get too deep in it, but they were like all locked down in a...
No, we don't need to delve into a different movie.
Yeah.
It's crazy to think we've gotten maybe an hour into this. As far as the recording goes, the actual video length might be different now.
Mm.
Still haven't talked about dinosaur attacks.
All right, let's talk
about dinosaur attacks. Let's just get into it, I guess. Okay. It's crazy, but I feel like it was warranted because, like, look, this movie... Everyone talks about the dinosaur attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So we just need to touch on it a little bit. They look great. I mean, it's literally the thing people talk about, because a lot of these shots still look good.
Mm-hmm.
The CG itself might be lacking in that solid texture that mm-hmm. we come to expect now, but it's 1993.
Yeah.
The way they were able to combine what they had with puppets, mm-hmm. animatronics,
mm-hmm.
it just genuinely works.
Yeah.
The T-Rex attack is a great example. Mm. The scene where it's like, it's raining. Everything about it is made to complement the technology. You don't see that much of the T-Rex at once.
Mm-hmm.
It just works great. I mean, that whole sequence where the T-Rex is like attacking the windshield and the kids are under it.
Yeah.
I loved that sequence. And that isn't CG. So like, I'm trying to organize my thoughts. When you constantly flip between CG and other means of effects, you're kind of tricking the human brain, because the human brain never gets enough time to go, that's fake.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, how is this fake?
Yeah.
And it works so well. So that scene is, if I'm not mistaken, it's a giant animatronic T-Rex head that's pushing the windshield against the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And it works so well. It looks so real. Even though I cracked the same lame joke both times, I was watching this movie alone, but I don't know if you do this, but when I watch movies alone, I react audibly still. Mm-hmm. I'm like, woo, that. Every time they do it, though, every time I saw the movie, the T-Rex is attacking, and the thing on my mind is, thank God we sprang for the T-Rex-proof windshields. The same corny joke.
That's funny.
I feel like George Costanza in that one Seinfeld when he's trying to heckle movies. He's in the auditorium mm-hmm. with people, and he's like, that's gotta hurt. But it's because the movie was so engaging that it brought it out. I was having that much fun.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, I don't even care if I was that George Costanza clip.
Mm. You know what makes me, what made me feel like that, where I'm like, I do react audibly sometimes to stuff. I can't remember if there was anything in this movie that did, but there were several times where I'm like, I felt like oh God, like this is crazy. And or I like sat up a little bit because I wanted, like, you know how sometimes something is a super tense scene or suspenseful, you're like, you may like get closer to the TV. I haven't done that in so long, which was like why I left the movie being like, oh damn, like we're so back. People like, movies are back, guys.
Nicole Kidman was right.
You know what? That just reminded me, like, you know what I felt like? I felt like Regina King in Scary Movie when she was in the movie.
Oh my god, yeah.
Like, oh, bitch, I'm having a heart attack. Like, oh, I am scared. Like, yo, that was me when the fucking, when the car was getting like flipped over.
And right, he, right. It got in the tree.
Yeah.
And then it fell off the tree.
But when the T-Rex was like nudging it, like just hitting it with its her head, I'm like, oh my god. And then when they flipped over and like it was like smooshing it down when the kids were in there, I was like, holy fuck, like I know this movie and I know they don't die, but how are they not dead right now?
I felt that way about when Alan was trying to get Timmy out of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then the car just falls down and then it falls on them and he's just like, well, we're in the car again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That. which is the best part of the movie. There's a huge gaffe in the storytelling there, though.
Mm-hmm.
The goat that was chained earlier, they could see it, which means that wooded area was leveled to where they were. Why was there suddenly like a 30 or 40 foot drop?
Mm.
Yeah. But you know, it doesn't matter in the moment because the drama is so heightened.
Mm-hmm.
It's just kind of like, oh yeah, that is kind of like a huge like plot hole. But it doesn't matter. And for all we know, maybe there's like some deleted sequence or something where they drove to a part where there's a drop. Mm. Or, you know, like maybe something happened in the edit.
Yeah.
One of the things I really wanted to talk about in regards to Lex, too, is her scene where she is in the kitchen with Timmy and they're running away from the velociraptors.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. What a masterclass in suspense. Just first off, it does everything that you love in a good action scene and a good chase scene. Your protagonists are at a disadvantage. They are kids. Mm-hmm. Those are velociraptors. I don't think I need to explain it past that. They are in a confined area with no easy means of escape, which means that a confrontation has to happen. Like, the movie makes you think they might be able to sneak out, but realistically, like, shit's gonna hit the fan.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are so woefully outgunned, our protagonists have to use their intelligence. They have to improvise. Jackie Chan is like the master of this. He's always at a disadvantage. It's always him versus like 20 guys. Yeah. He always has to use a ladder or a paper bag or something to fight.
Mm-hmm.
And in this, what they end up using, it's the chrome. It's the fact that it's a clean chrome kitchen where everything casts shadows. So the scene where the velociraptor's chasing her and she's in like the cabinet or something and it just fucking beams its head against a different cabinet because it was casting a reflection of her.
Clever girl.
yeah, like actually though. No, it was just so good. And the use of CG and puppets is like exemplary there.
Yeah.
Whenever you only see half of a velociraptor, you know it's a puppet.
Mm-hmm.
But it does so much to make the scene feel grounded and real.
Yeah, that was the first scene that I thought, oh man, Spielberg's just the man, dude.
Yeah.
Because that was so suspenseful and it was like another example of something that could have been a little cheesy, just working, like 100% just working.
Speaking of Spielberg being the best or one of the best to ever do it, you want to know what's even crazier? Shot Jurassic Park, after assembling the first cut, left to shoot Schindler's List, worked on the movie while shooting Schindler's List.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a bonus thing for you. Guess who helped him get things done while he was away? Our boy George Lucas.
Oh, shit.
He directed the overdubbing, like the loops and the ADR. He did like some of that stuff.
Damn, cool. Yeah. So, I was going to mention, what a year for this guy. Jurassic Park, then Schindler's List.
Yeah.
Like
crazy. Back to back. Mm-hmm. And the reason he made Jurassic Park, the reason it worked like this is when Universal got the rights, he said he wanted to do Schindler's List also.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, okay, you can do both, but you have to shoot Jurassic Park first. So I really do mean it when I say, yeah, Spielberg's one of the best to ever do it.
Mm-hmm.
And this movie feels, I love when artists reference their previous work. And this movie feels very much like him riffing on some of his older work. Like parts of this movie feel like Jaws. He himself has said he was trying to make Jaws on land. And I felt like there was a lot of Indiana Jones in this too, in Alan in particular.
Yeah,
They're flying to the island, he's doing the Indiana Jones thing with the hat.
And the seatbelt situation.
So I wrote that too. It's so indie.
Yeah, just like. And being like, I don't know what to do with this. And then they're like, oh, it'll take, we'll be landed by the time you figure it out. And he just ties it and just like, there we go. We're good.
So Indiana Jones.
Yeah, very much.
To the point where you could almost ask, like, what if Jurassic Park was Indiana Jones 4? every Indiana Jones movie is always about recovering some ancient thing, mm-hmm. and then something supernatural happens. I don't think it would have been better. I'm not saying it should have been. Mm-hmm. I'm saying, like, it could have made sense. Like, yeah, I could see that working a little bit.
Imagine Indy 4 with, but they keep Laura Dern as the love interest, but they do end up using Jim Carrey as Ian Malcolm. That would be a fucking movie.
For some reason, I thought you were going to be like, they end up using Jim Carrey as Short Round. Okie dokie, Mr. Jones. You know, just fucking goes with it. It's just Jim Carrey as Jim Carrey. He's called Short Round, but he's taller than Harrison Ford, I think.
Yeah, I think so too. That's funny. So,
yeah, so much of this movie. And it's great to think, like, it's an action movie. Again, like, the wiki calls it that. But at its core, it's just so character focused. Mm-hmm. It just feels like more of a movie, like a film than a movie to me.
I would say, like, you got to throw, like, either thriller or suspense in there. Thriller is probably more...
Some of this can be called a horror movie.
Yeah.
I know it's rated PG, but, like, you know. It's just, yeah, what a great movie, genuinely. I'm so glad we decided to kick off Glaring Admissions with this, because it is literally a movie where I've wanted to watch it, but I've kind of shied away because it's like, oh, but you get it already. Go watch something else, you know. And yeah, I was thoroughly surprised by that. I was proven wrong, and I'm happy to admit I was proven wrong. Mm.
It's cool that I think we'll have that opportunity to feel that way. One of us will, like, almost every episode.
Yeah, presumably every episode.
Because, I mean, there will be films where I will be like, I didn't really want to get into that. Like the Lord of the Rings.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, that's one where I'm like, I've seen them all, but, like, they just genuinely, I just,
sure,
whatever.
That will be a thing, because for the longest time, I refused to watch the Lord of the Rings trilogy as a kid. And then, like, I read the books and stuff, but I was never a Lord of the Rings guy, so that'll have to be an episode. But just to circle around Jurassic Park one more time, I talked about how I had never seen Jurassic Park before, and I really do mean it when I say that I've wanted to for a while. It's just, it is one of those things where movies, I guess, like, let's, to wrap things up, I guess we should touch on why we're making the show. I know we did earlier, but to get into it a bit more, it is this idea that movies are too big to fail, or not too big to fail, but too big sometimes. Like, some movies can become so big that they're no longer just a movie. Mm-hmm. And Jurassic Park is one of those things. While I was watching Jurassic Park, I was basically aware of everything that was happening as it was happening. Aside from the stuff about, like, Alan growing to want children and stuff like that, the mechanizations of the plot were familiar to me. And that didn't take away from my enjoyment of the movie, which is precisely why I kind of wanted to start this show with you. Because I've noticed a thing where culturally a lot of people will just read the wiki for a movie. Oh, why do I need to know? Why do I need to sit through a 2-hour movie when I can read 4 paragraphs? You know? And you really are missing out on a lot. And I say that as a person that waited till he was 28 years old to watch Jurassic Park, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I was really looking forward to us making a show like this, or this specific show, because of what we talked about before. You know, our people who support us, that we, at least for me, that I, like, actually know personally, friends or family.
Sure.
They always say to me that, oh, it would be cool if you guys did something like Men in Black or whatever.
Something,
you know,
we give a shit about.
Yeah, something we've seen before.
I don't know what he's talking about, by the way. I've never experienced support from another human being. When I was a baby, my mom asked if I wanted milk. I said yes. And she was like, get it your damn self. Kicked me to the curb. But
besides, like, wanting to give the people what they want, it's really about the experience, like what you're saying, how people kind of deprive themselves of that experience of watching, going to the movies or watching a movie. It's an experience. Like, this is art. I'm not gonna get on my soapbox about this.
I will.
People don't really look at movies and television as, like, art. I think
Increasingly, you know? So. Yeah. It does feel like we're kind of entering this era of like everything is content.
Yeah.
You know, so, it's just a thing to pass the time. And mm-hmm. that's fine. But to quote Kramer from Seinfeld, we've done that a lot already this episode, just quoted Seinfeld. But like there's this whole spiel about like, why would I go to the movies when I can watch the exact same movie on TV? Mm-hmm. He's like, well, why would you go to a restaurant if you could just use a microwave?
Yeah.
You know? Like the deliberation of sitting down to watch a movie, even if you can engage with it in a faster, more efficient way, is special. It's like, why would you use Spotify? Or why would you use a record player when you can use Spotify? Because when I use a record player, I'm confined to a room with speakers and I can't do, I mean, presumably I can't do the dishes. I can't, you know, unless you've gone out of your way to set it up. It's important that we give time to art. And I think it's also just like an inclusive thing. I think a lot of the arts are, people like to call art people pretentious or snobby.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you haven't seen Jurassic, and to some extent we are. Like, I think a lot of people who, like, I know people who get frustrated when I'm like, oh yeah, I've never seen Game of Thrones. Like, what? Why? And it's like, I understand this is coming from a place of enthusiasm and love for Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make me feel like a leper, because then I'm not going to do it. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel you on that. Like, that's, especially if you're talking to someone who also considers themselves like a, you know, film person or TV person, they're like, you've never seen that? Like, oh, how could you have never seen that? It does that. Those are the moments. And, you know, we went to fucking...
we studied film.
Yeah. So we've encountered our share of fucking pretentious assholes.
It's not even pretentiousness for me. It's the expression of love for something in a maybe a misguided way. Some might say we're being overly sensitive about it, but I think it matters. I think when you say to somebody like, hey, you know, you really like film. That's super cool. You haven't seen this? Oh, okay. Well, would you want to watch it sometime maybe?
Mm-hmm.
Instead of, oh, you're going to fucking love this. Let's sit down and do it right now. Or go do it immediately. Like, don't be a dick about it.
Or like, it's what I found, my experience with people who are, you know, into the same things as we are, film, television, you know, the creative people. Number one, we are just sensitive in general, normally. Creative people are usually pretty sensitive, dramatic, all that. I think that describes anyone who does anything creatively.
For real.
But we also sometimes develop this like elitist complex where we think because consuming art makes you feel pretty good. And then if you consume art and then like, let's say a movie, for example. Let's use The Holdovers, for example, one that I'm going to watch tomorrow. That's why I'm thinking of it. That is a movie that people really love. And if you love it, and then it's the same thing with anything. If you like an artist, a movie or whatever, and then it turns out that other people enjoy it too, you're like, I'm the fucking smartest guy. Like, I'm so good at this.
Yeah.
And you sometimes, the thing that I don't like is that people can kind of make you feel small when you don't know of or have watched, or maybe you don't agree with someone's assessment of something. So
art is really interesting because it's like simultaneously communal and competitive.
Mm-hmm.
And the competitive side of it is like a pure aspect of it that's just kind of brought about by like economics. Like you need to make money as a filmmaker, as a painter, you want to sell your painting. So there's a competitive side to it that's inextricably tied to it, but kind of incompatible with it.
Because
like no movie is made by one person, you know? Every movie requires a full village of people working on it.
Yeah.
It requires a ton of voices coalescing and creating one singular voice. But you guys, it's also herd mentality because you have to go up against the other movie that was the same exact thing. And part of like why I think this show is like a great idea is like, we're just people trying to consume this stuff. We don't, it doesn't need to be a dick measuring contest. We can just talk about, oh, Nick has never seen Jurassic Park, far out. I wonder what he thought of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Not, oh, he's a fucking idiot. But in all seriousness, if you haven't seen the 1992 film Terminator 2 Judgment Day, you might actually be fucking stupid. No, I'm kidding, obviously. 92, I think it was 92, 91, whenever. At any rate, thank you for watching. This is the end of our first episode. We have a bunch of cool ones planned out.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really excited. I really hope we do the second movie we've been talking about, which is Total Recall.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say E.T.
No, we're gonna give Spielberg. We gotta pace ourselves. Mm-hmm. But we're gonna do Total Recall now, yeah. Which you've never seen.
I've never seen that. No.
And that's like one of my favorite action movies. You and I watched Starship Troopers recently together.
Yeah, great.
So yeah. You're already kind of like a little familiar with Paul Verhoeven, but it's gonna be a good time for sure. So if you guys are excited for that, you know, stay tuned, check it out. Let us know a famous movie you've never seen before, stuff like that.
Yeah.
So yeah. Bye.
Bye.